Accession number 27083, reel 54.
So, Henry, the question really is twofold. Had any of your predecessors as CNC channel, had they had a shot at attempting to join the NPG? Did you know that? And what were your specific reasons at this time for feeling that you needed to be, that Sync Channel needed to be a member of NPG?
Well, as for the first question, I can't be dogmatic about it. I'm not aware that they had. They certainly hadn't thrown down the gauntlet to the extent that I did. So that was a first off. My reason was that I, even in my early days, I became increasingly aware that it was in the margins of the NPG where the really important business of NATO got done in terms of decision taking.
And who were the constituents of NPG prior to your arrival? Apart from the two Americans, who else was there?
I think it was the defense secretaries in person.
Of the NATO countries. 12 members or whatever
yes.
It was.
I think that was it.
So it was a highly political group rather than a... If you've got 12 defense secretaries and perhaps... SACA and SAC Atlantic.
Well, not perhaps. I mean, they were members.
Well, yes.
Full members. Because they were MNC, or
yes.
So it was said.
Yes.
And there was I, a so-called MNC, but not a member of the NPG.
Right.
And since we were a nuclear power, it was an anomaly. No question about it.
Were they the only two military members of the NPG, the two Americans?
Yes.
They were?
Yes.
So you were joining, in fact, there would be three of you.
Yes.
And you were joining a wholly political group, really.
Yes.
Right. Okay. But I'm just trying to get the...
On the nuclear side, you see, ultimately the decision is political.
Yeah.
I haven't mentioned the French. The French by then had withdrawn militarily from NATO. And so they acted in support of it. And it was a very tenuous situation. And they were... It was a typical goalist approach, and they did things when they wanted to do things and didn't when they didn't, and usually they didn't. It was difficult. Well, that was that. I think enough on the basic NATO stuff. I turned now to various visits and things, but that occurred in the back end of 78. An incident which created a certain amount of furore later on, several years later. The Falklands blew hot. I'm talking of December 78. The Falklands had blown hot on an annual basis for certainly the previous 16 years. Sometimes it was just lukewarm, sometimes it was quite hot, but always in a matter of a few weeks, a couple of months at worst, it all blew over and the status quo ante was resumed. This looked like being another one, except that it wasn't a lukewarm blowing up, it was blowing up quite hot. And suffice it to say that the decision, which was not mine, was way over my head as the fleet commander, the decision was taken to deploy in secret a small force of two frigates accompanied by an oiler, a tanker, and they were to hold off 1,000 miles north of the Falklands. And a nuclear submarine, which was to hold off 2,000 miles north of the Falklands. And the Falklands are 8,000 miles away from UK. And this whole operation was to be clandestine, and it was not to not to be publicized at all. It was kept as a very guarded secret. And remarkably, it was so kept. And the frigates and the tanker were sailed from the base ports, and they rendezvoused. Submarine was the nuclear submarine was easier. She was sailed from Fares Lane, and so forth. The next thing I knew, I mean, I was entirely in on all this. Indeed, had to select the ships and order them about their business. But I suppose this would have been early December, and about mid-December, the First Sea Lord, by then Terry Lewin, who I knew very well and worked with often before, he'd been vice chief when I was assistant chief and so on, and our minds were very much in tune. But to my great surprise, he personally got on the phone to me one day and said, I hope you've arranged for a mail drop for Christmas for this force. And I said, no, I had not. And if this is to be kept secret, we couldn't possibly have a mail drop, because all the wives would know that something was up. And their dear husbands were not going to be home for Christmas, which clearly they were not going to be. And he didn't like this. He said, we've got to have a mail drop. And to me, this seemed to be absurd. And I may say it was one of the very few occasions that I actively opposed Terry Lewin, because I thought he was fundamentally wrong on this. Because it would leak out, be bound to. And finally, he realized that I was, I felt strongly about this, and he finally gave me a direct order, organize a mail drop. So I shut up and organized it. And the cat did not jump out of the bag. The crisis, in quotes, blew over, as it had done previously. And about the first week in January or so, the ships concerned returned to their base ports for delayed Christmas leave, and still nothing leaked out, which was remarkable. And I, to this day, I'm duly grateful, but I don't understand how we got away with that. Now, this came up, and I might as well bring it up now. This came up in 82 in the course of the, either during or in the aftermath of the Falklands War, when there was argument as to why we hadn't taken the same action clandestinely and so forth. And the argument centered around whether the then Foreign Secretary, who I think was David Owen in 78, had informed the his Argentine opposite number, and therefore to that extent it served as a deterrent, and that's why it all blew over, or not. And I never actually had this out with David Owen himself, who I class as a friend now, and he's one of the few statesmen still around, I think. But of course, if it had remained, if this had not been revealed to the Argentines, there could have been no deterrent effect, because nobody knew anything about it. Simple as that.
So the secrecy was entirely at the British end, if
yes.
you like. But, of course, the Argentines were advised.
Well, this I don't know still, whether they were or not. I had personally always regarded it as a precautionary move against, well, against invasion. Come to that. Not that we could have stopped it, but we could have made life difficult. And once we knew that things were going to deteriorate, we could have declared our hand, we could have moved the forces concerned closer to the Falklands, and would have done, and then said, all right, stop, or we will. And the nuclear submarine was well able to exert a threat of that nature.
What were the arguments against, and was this course of action ever considered, to hold small exercises down there once a year? Would that have been sufficient, do you think, to have conveyed to the Argentine junta that any military action was most unwise if you'd held annual exercises rather than just relying on endurance?
I don't think really, because at that stage the Argentinians didn't really mean business. And it was only when the level of what came to be called, and I shall return to this later, came to be termed the dirty war, do you know what I mean, where people were just removed from their homes or offices or whatever and disappeared.
Oh, on the mainland of Argentina.
On the mainland of Argentina, never to return. And sooner or later, because the dirty war involved thousands, not very many thousands, I don't think, but it was into the thousands. And the situation was reached at the time that they did invade, when the mob was howling at the gates. And the only panacea then
was a giant
the Malvinas.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a most interesting comment. So that you feel that that prior to, shall we say, December 78 or 77, the junta was in reasonable control in Argentina, but subsequent to that it became more difficult for them. They started to arrest their own citizens, all those difficulties they had, it got worse and worse, and therefore the Falklands invasion was a massive diversion of public attention in Argentina.
Absolutely that. It was a last-ditch let-out on the part of the Argentine administration. I shall return to this in more detail later,
yeah,
but that's exactly what it amounted to then. And the dirty war hadn't assumed the really very vigorous proportions that it eventually did by the end of 78, which is the time I'm talking of. I divert now to one or two visits, in no special order. I had visited France. I'd had a very good visit, and I won't go into details about how it had gone. But amongst other places, I visited Brest and was shown round one of the strategic Polaris equivalent nuclear submarines the whole way through the boat, including the reactor compartment, which normally nobody was shown at all. And in return, when the head of the French Navy, who was a charming man, paid his... No, I don't mean the head of the Navy, it was the submarine commander. The fleet commander, rather, when he came back for a return visit, I arranged, rather to Admiral Lynn, Fessy Lord's, rather to his disgust, I think, that he should come out with me and meet one of our returning Polaris boats. Now, I'd already done this, and I made a point of trying to meet each one as they returned from patrol. In the course of which, of course, they did a debrief on anything that had occurred during their patrol, subject to there being a rigged debrief. In fact, no debrief at all, really. I saw no harm whatsoever, and I thought it was the least we could do to try and cement the trust that they had bestowed in me. Not to be shown through the reactor compartment, but the rest would follow.
What is so, if you're able to say, what is so secret about the reactor? I mean, that's just the power generation of the boat, isn't it, or not?
It is the power generation of the boat, but it contains the... if you know enough about it, you can see certain things which would indicate how you go about achieving that precise generation, which varies with, you can't just say that a nuclear reactor is a nuclear reactor and that's it. There are various types and various methods of getting around various problems and so forth. And this was regarded as the core of what had to be kept undercover, under the hat.
How interesting. I would have thought it would have been the weapon system and the firing system and how and things like that.
Yes, but all you saw was consoles. And you could see the beasts in the launch tubes and so forth. And it was just another missile.
Right.
But you wouldn't learn by looking. In the reactor compartment, you could learn certain details, which maybe this was overdone, but which at the time weren't generally known. Well, I got away with this, and I met the French admiral up at wherever it was on the west coast of Scotland, and took him out in a helicopter in the Sea King. I can't remember which boat it was, and we winched down and so forth. And I warned the submarine, of course, in advance that this was happening, and I gave them explicit instructions about security and how nothing by way of the normal debriefing was to take place and so on. And they played up very well. And they gave us a great welcome on board, and he was shown round. Of course, he was entirely familiar with pretty well everything he saw and so on. And then we gathered in the wardroom, and there weapons electrical officer was a Scotsman, and he had he donned a kilt for this occasion, and he had his bagpipes on board, and the Frenchman was served a tot of rum, which of course had been abolished by then as a normal issue. He was served a tot of rum while this chap stumped up and down playing his bagpipes. He was then taken forward to the forward mess deck, where most of those not actually on watch, the ship's company had gathered, for the result of the patrol sweep, draw. This was a routine thing that all the boats did. And in the period of a patrol, there was quite a lot of money involved. And to my acute embarrassment, the French admiral fished out his pocketbook and produced I forget what it was, a 5,000 franc note, and tossed it onto the table. And I hadn't got a penny on me. So I had to borrow from the CO and say, you know, I'll refund later, and so forth. And I felt a bit stupid over that.
That's but £500.
But it may not have been 5,000, it may have been 1,000, I don't know. But it was quite a substantial thing.
Yes.
I've never been able to fathom how many francs go to the what. but there it was. He was a very nice man, and he entered into the spirit of it all, and that was great fun. Another visit I made, which I thought was important. By this time, I had been the rounds of the ministries of defence in the main NATO member countries. And at risk of being left out were the lesser fry. And so I made a point of going to the Faroes. And I did this, I think I did it in a Danish frigate. And it was all very low-key stuff. The senior officer there, I think, was a commander in their navy, and so on. And they looked after me very well. And when I came to Leeds, and of course one was, I say this against myself, one packed really every minute of one's time as the fleet commander to such an extent that you were at least at risk of not having allowed enough margin for error, which could have had quite politically damaging circumstances, because somebody would have been insulted and so forth. But when I came to leave the Faroes, there was thick fog, and I was relying on the frigate to take me back, and I was going to be winched up by a helicopter and so forth. So that was quite hairy, because I had, I can't remember what it was now, another highly important engagement to this very tight schedule. But worse was to come. I also paid a visit to Greenland. And if you remember your schoolboy atlas, and there is Greenland, which is a heavily sort of frilly coastline with about a quarter of an inch of pale green and nothing else, and all inside, inland of that, is just white. And that's exactly what Greenland looks like. And the white part is just glaciers. And apart from the coastal strip, which I think, and it varies a bit, is no more than something like 7 miles wide, that's precisely what it is. I flew there, and they had, I can't remember the names of the airfields, I flew into an airstrip down in the south, in a Nimrod, with the air commander from, who was my opposite number at Northwood, the maritime air commander, and he was going to stay in Iceland, and we stopped off at Iceland on the way. I was not visiting Iceland on that occasion as such, and I went on to Greenland and got there. And I saw the little headquarters, NATO. Again, pretty low-key stuff. Might have been a captain, probably a commander, I think. And I embarked in the local frigate. And was taken round the corner and up the coast, where I spent a night. And it was very interesting. You could see, you really could see what the country was like, and what we had to deal with. They looked after me very well, and when I left the upcountry base, which was about halfway up, I suppose, the weather was bad. It deteriorated on our way south, and it was frightfully important that I got back to the airstrip where I had landed, because, again, I'd cut it absurdly fine, really, and almost immediately on my return to Northwood, via Iceland, I had the entire NATO council, which included the French, coming to lunch. Never been done before, and it was a big, big thing. And it was a particular thing that the French were included. So it was important that there was no hitch in the drill. And in the middle of the night on passage down, it took about a night's journey to come down, the weather got worse and worse and worse, to the extent that the frigate couldn't go in to within helicopter range of the landing strip. And it was at that point that I realized that I should have had a greater margin for error, but I hadn't. So, desperate, I persuaded the frigate captain to summon his pilot. They had a I forget what sort of helicopter they had. It was only a little one. And I suggested that the captain could find some other field that would provide more shelter and would enable the pilot of the helicopter at least to get off. And having got off, well, then he could take me to the airstrip, I hoped. And this was duly done. And it was pretty hairy. There was just the flag lieutenant and myself, and it was and the pilot. And the pilot didn't like it much, but he was a good sport. A bit reckless, I think. It wasn't really flying weather. But we found another field that had provided more shelter, and off we went. And we landed at the airstrip, and the helicopter didn't shut down, immediately took off again. And as you got out of the helicopter, you were practically blown over. The wind was so strong. And this was around lunchtime. And the commanding officer of the airstrip had us into his house and said that there was no question of flying on. And the Nimrod, which was to have picked us up, couldn't possibly get in. And then he revealed a piece of information which had not reached me before, namely that at the end of the following day, the airstrip closed for the winter and didn't reopen for another 6 months. There was an American Air Force base about halfway up the coast, a little way away, to which the Nimrod had gone, and that was all right, but how to get up the coast? Not by sea, and not in a helicopter. They didn't have anything else there, and so on. It was tricky. Well, then we had a sandwich lunch, and we'd been up quite a bit of the previous night, and we were given a couple of rooms, and there was nothing for it but to have a kip. We couldn't do anything except hope that the weather would improve, and it didn't. And then news came through that some aircraft flying from America was due to land in order to refuel because it was running out of fuel. And we thought, right, we'll get a lift in this. But it diverted at the last minute, anyway it went. And the evening wore on and it began to, dark was approaching.
And you have to be at Northwood at 12 noon the following day.
The following day, yes.
Right.
And eventually we got a signal, the airstrip got a signal, that a light, it was an HS-125, I think, had been bought by some industrial magnet in, I can't remember which country, I think it was Denmark. And the Danish captain and engineer had been over in the States to take delivery of this machine, and they had an American engineer just in case anything went wrong, and they were on their way back to Denmark. And they too were, because it had been a strong headwind and they were running low on fuel. And so I turned to my flag lieutenant in the presence of the CEO of the airstrip, who spoke good English, and said, right, when this guy comes, you, pointing at the CEO, are to refuse to give him a teaspoonful of fuel until he has assured us that he'll take us on to Iceland, where we pick up the Nimrod. We had good communication, so we could tell the others what we were up to and so on. And this aircraft came in, and it only just made it. But it did make it. And we clustered outside the door, and we were all set to say, you know, I'm sorry, you're hijacked. And we were wearing uniform, of course. They couldn't have been a nicer lot. And we didn't have to threaten anything. And they were perfectly happy to take us onto Iceland, where they were going in any case, from Reykjavik en route back to Denmark. And that was that. And so we, in due course, we refueled, we took off Reykjavik. And meantime, we had primed the Nimrod, and it had gone ahead, back to Reykjavik. And in the small hours of the morning, very small hours, we landed at Reykjavik and transferred to the Nimrod, where I found a rather rueful air commander. why do sailors behave in such an irresponsible fashion, and so forth. And without, frankly, much difficulty, we persuaded the Nimrod, instead of going back to Kinloss, to go to Browse Norton, which was closer to home, because I was desperate for time. And we went to Browse Norton, and I was picked up by my car and went to Admiralty House, where